Hey folks, the Other People Podcast is a free show. All episodes are offered freely. Your support makes a difference. If you like the program and you want to support it, you can do so at patreon.com/otherpplpod. Oh, thanks.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jeez, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person.
Hey,
just
hi, everybody.
Time.
How's it going? Right. Hey there. Right. This is Brad Listy. I'm the Other People show host. This is the Other People podcast. It's good to be with you. I have Megan O'Giblin on the program. She has an essay collection out from Anchor Books. It's called Interior States. It is the official October pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. TheNervousBreakdown.com is my online literary community. It has its own monthly book club. The way it works is you get a book delivered to your door every month, and then I interview the author on this program. That's what's happening here. It's an enriching cultural experience. I had a good time talking with Megan O'Giblin. That conversation is coming up in just a second. I do want to answer some questions, or at least a couple of questions from listeners. I have a listener named J.M. Dalton who says, what's a question that you regret asking? What's a question that you regret not asking? I think I regret sometimes asking questions that have to do with really sensitive cultural issues. I mean, I think I'm kind of two minds on it because I feel like you do need to go there. But sometimes I feel like I either ask inartfully or I respond poorly or, you know, I'm not ready to have the conversation because I haven't thought it through yet. So it's usually stuff tied to race or gender. That's usually where I have like most of my regrets as a host after the fact. But I say that and I remember, and I've probably made the same comment in conversation on the program recently, but it's been on my mind, you know, as all of these like conversations are swirling and there's so much tension and conflict and everything. When I was growing up, the adage was that you were not supposed to talk about like politics, religion, and what's the other one? Sex? I can't remember. Politics, religion, money. That's the other one. Don't talk about politics, religion, or money was always, you know, that was what was handed down to me. It's rude to talk about politics, religion, you know, and money. I think those are some of my favorite things to talk about. I think we actually need to talk about those things more. So I have kind of a countervailing, is that the right word, opinion on that? Now I'm worried that I just misused the word countervailing. Hang on a second. Might have totally misused that. I'm so, you know, my brain is shot. To act or avail against with equal power, force, or effect. Counteract. To furnish an equivalent of or a con. See, countervailing's not really the right word. There's a better word and it's escaping me. It's not counterintuitive. It's contradictory. That's the word I wanted. I have a contradictory opinion on that. I think you should talk about money. I think you should talk about religion, and I think you should talk about politics, but ideally talk about it well. I think the general point is that I think we just need to have these conversations out in the open more, and it'll ventilate things. But I know that they can get sticky, which is where I think the maxim comes from in the first place, because it tends to lead to, you know, polarization and conflict and miserable Thanksgiving dinners and all the rest. Ben Tanzer asks, what happened next? it's in past tense. It's very confusing. What happened next? I wasn't sure. I feel like silence is good there as we all try to figure out what happened next. The verb tense on that one sort of threw me. Rebecca Hussey asks, do you see yourself doing the podcast indefinitely? Do you think about quitting? What might make you quit? Please don't quit. I think ideally I will do the podcast. Like I've said this before, but my goal is to podcast until I'm 90. And possibly beyond. I want to say I did the math, and if I continue to do one episode a week for the rest of my life, I would get to like 3,000 episodes. Now, I say that, and I have a very demanding job that takes up almost all of my time, and it is getting harder for me to do these interviews and to then produce the show. It's like, I have a lot of demands on my time. So that would be the thing that would make me like have to hang it up or press pause. It's just, I don't want to put, here's the thing. It's got to be at a level that I feel like is worthwhile for everybody. I don't want to put out a bad show. I don't want to put forth conversations where I feel like I'm not doing the job because I'm too tired or my brain is just shot. But as long as I'm, delivering something that I feel good about and that the authors who come talk to me feel good about and that you guys feel good about, then I'll keep going. I like it. I've said that before. So I think that's it for listener questions in this round. Let's get to the conversation with Megan O'Giblin. Her essay collection is called Interior States, and it is excellent. It is the official October selection of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. It is available now. Go get your copy. Here she is, folks. This is Megan O'Giblin.
So I grew up kind of all over the Midwest, mostly in Michigan, but my family moved around a lot. So we were in Michigan, part of the time on the West Coast and part of the time on sort of the east side of the state. We lived in Peoria for a little while. We lived in Wisconsin for a couple of years when I was in high school. And my childhood was, I don't know how representative of the Midwest it was, but we were, I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian family. I was homeschooled up until 10th grade. So my social life was really circumscribed to church, homeschool group, kind of these very cloistered Christian communities. I didn't have a sense of living anywhere in particular when I was growing up. I didn't have a sense of being a Midwesterner, which I think is actually probably the most typical Midwestern experience. I think there's a case to be made that is very typical of people who grew up in this region, is this illusion that you just live, in sort of an average American town, or that there's nothing truly unique or regionally unique about the setting. I think it's different from somebody who grows up in the South or somebody who grows up in, say, Texas or somewhere where you have this very intense sense of national identity or regional identity. But I don't know. I've written a lot about my childhood and growing up in evangelicalism. I grew up, in the 90s at the height of the megachurch movement. So there was a very robust Christian youth culture. We were always going to these major conferences and concerts. Christian music, Christian contemporary music was huge when I was in high school.
And what were you, and what was the belief system? It's Jesus is the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like fire and brimstone? There's going to be, there's going to be a rapture?
Yeah, definitely all of that. So when I was a child, we got a lot of sort of the old school fire and brimstone, particularly when I was very young. We went to this very traditional Baptist congregation where the pastor talked about hell all the time. There was also, this sense that the end times were imminent. The theology we believed in was very millenarian. It was very concerned with the end times and the future. Our pastor was constantly bringing up events from the news as evidence that, the prophecies were being fulfilled, that the tribulation was going to happen at any moment. I used to come home sometimes and find the house empty and be convinced that the rapture had happened and I was left behind, you know. So like this was a very like...
Wait, why was your house empty?
Well, I don't know. You know, if I came home and I thought my parents were home and they were actually out in the yard or something.
Oh, I thought you meant it had been like cleared out of like furniture.
No, just the people. Only the people are raptured. All the material possessions.
Oh, right. They don't take the couches and the...
They don't take the couches, the sinners and non-believers. Yeah, they all get left behind.
And what about like gay people, not good, that kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah, very much. There was no sense of, you know, social justice, which is now, I think there's a lot more diversity within within the evangelicalism itself. I think there's a lot more openness, as particularly among young people, toward like LGBT issues, toward social justice. But when I was growing up, that was not the case at all.
Yeah. So do you think that there is a very direct through line between the evangelical movements or communities of the Midwest or the upper Midwest and those that might exist, say, in like South Mississippi or Texas? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, is it the same thing, or do you think it's markedly different?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to act like I'm an authority on this, because I'm not. But my sense is that in the South, there's a stronger charismatic tradition than there is in the Midwest. There's a lot more, like Pentecostal churches where people are speaking in tongues, and there's like snakes and spirit slaying and things like this. That I think is a little bit more common in the South. In fact, when I was at Moody Bible Institute, which is where I went to college for 2 years, very small conservative Christian school in Chicago. I remember overhearing a professor saying that that was a common thing with these students who had come from sort of from southern states to study theology, that they had to be, that they sort of had to get assimilated to this more conservative Midwestern theology that didn't approve of things like that. Of speaking in tongues, say, or like even
like that's what you get busted for at Moody Bible College in your freshman dorm.
Yeah, yeah, that and like watching movies. We weren't allowed to watch movies or play cards.
What about dancing? Is dancing happening?
No, yeah, no dancing. But no, I think they've actually loosened up on that in like the past few years. But when I was there was no dancing.
But there has to be so much illicit stuff going on, right? Or are the people walking the straight and narrow if they're there?
There was a few people who were doing, myself included, illicit things while we were there. It's not the same as, you know, I don't know. I had a lot of friends who went to like liberal arts Christian colleges in the Midwest that are sort of more, I don't know, the places like
Wheaton,
you know, even like, yeah, Wheaton, right, where there's people who you're going there to get like, I don't know, you can study anything, but you're also getting a Christian education. So I think there's a lot more of sort of like a secretive party culture there than there is somewhere like Moody. Like everybody who was at Moody was there basically to go into full-time ministry. So you really got, I don't know, I think it sort of weeded out people who were you know, looking for something else, or whose parents had pressured them to go there. I don't know. I mean, I think there were people there who were maybe confused about their faith. I think like I was, but I think that was something that happened after they got there, as opposed to, you know, people who were there who didn't want to be there for that reason.
I got to say, it's a good name for a college. I mean, Moody Bible College.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. Has a nice ring to it.
It does. Yeah. It's after, yeah, the founder, Dwight L. Moody, who was like a famous American evangelist in the late 19th century. But yeah, it's funny. There is on the north side of Chicago, there's a pub called Moody's Pub, which is not related at all to the school. But a lot of people, the students who did drink, used to go there kind of as a joke.
subversive Bible college humor.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know really what the joke was, but yeah.
So I want to know about like your relationship to your faith as a young person. And I'm sure when you're impressionable and young and your parents are raising you, and you're surrounded by all of these adults who are sort of guiding you along your way, you don't question it quite as much. And clearly at some point you did. And can you just talk a little bit about how that happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't really question the faith at all when I was a child. And I think that's probably just proof of how completely sheltered we were as kids. Like, I literally didn't know any non-Christians. I mean, we had like some neighbors who were Catholic, who we would like pray for because they apparently weren't saved. But our whole world, all of my extended family were evangelical Christians. So I didn't really start, I guess, questioning. I don't know if I was like gung-ho Christian growing up. It was just sort of like the air we breathed in. It wasn't anything that felt like it had to be personal to me. When I went to Moody, I think I was exposed to the theology in a way that I hadn't been growing up, you know, because I think the theology that the average evangelical child and adolescent gets is actually very shallow. You know, it's very this sort of idea like, oh, Jesus is your best friend. He wants to have a personal relationship with you. And everything is sort of about this very emotional experience and having this personal relationship with Christ. And so then I get to Moody and we're reading, you know, parts of the Old Testament that I had never read. We're reading the book of Job, the book of Leviticus, you know, all of these sort of this violent military history that's, you know, justified according to Christian theology, confronting things like the problem of evil, hell. That was like a big thing for me, was actually confronting the theology of hell for the first time, I guess, from a doctrinal standpoint, as opposed to just the, you know, fire and brimstone stuff I'd heard from the pulpit as a child. I started questioning a lot of stuff while I was there and started asking questions and didn't really get many satisfactory answers from the professors. And then ended up having a faith crisis that lasted for several years. I left Moody after 2 years. I was supposed to stay for a 4-year program.
You were going to become a minister?
A missionary. I wanted to be a missionary. Yeah. I don't know. I think that was part of what made it so difficult, is like, how am I going to go, you know, try to convince other people of this belief system if I have all these doubts myself? And I don't know. I think part of the reason I left was like, I just have to like be alone and figure this out for myself and figure out what I think. You know, I felt like it was very difficult to figure out what I believed within that community, because there was we were discouraged from asking too many questions, and I felt really afraid, I think, of letting on how much doubt I had, because, people would worry about you.
They would think that you were not saved, or you were going to stray and go to hell?
Yeah, right. And, I think adding to it too, the doctrine we were taught at Moody was very Calvinist, which I don't know if that means anything to you or your listeners, but the theology we were taught was emphasized this idea of predestination, which means that, God chooses before you're born. Basically, everybody before they're born, God chooses who's going to be saved and who's not. And we actually don't have any free will. And this was an idea also that I had never heard when I was growing up. It wasn't something that I had been taught until I was at Moody. On one hand, I was struggling with that because it seemed incredibly unjust to me that, you know, God just made this choice that there are people that are going to be sent to hell for no fault of their own. I started having this very like self-conscious fear that like, oh, maybe if I am having these doubts, then I'm not one of the elect, and I was never supposed to be a Christian, you know? So I don't know. It was a lot to be sort of processing at the time. And, I think that was definitely contributing to sort of the fears and doubts that I had during that time.
I've always had a hard time having or processing relationships with people who are in, say, the evangelical faith tradition, who believe that anybody who does not believe what they believe is not saved and is therefore going to burn for eternity in hell or whatever, suffer for eternity in hell. And yet they have, you know, you can have like friendly relations with these people. I have family members, you know, and it's like, oh, everything's fine. But like, then there's always part of me that's going, so I guess they go home and just think to themselves like, yeah, he's going to burn. He doesn't get it, you know? And I find it, if I'm being totally honest, I find it a little offensive. It's like, wow, like they really are judging the shit out of me. And like, as if they know, do you know what I'm saying? I feel like there's there's a lot of hubris in that.
Well, do you also feel like kind of offended that they're not trying to evangelize you if they really believe that? Because that's like my husband had this realization, like the first time he came back to visit my family at home, my grandfather like cornered him at breakfast and gave him the talk. Like, you know that if you don't, you know, accept Jesus as your personal savior, the Bible says you're going to spend eternity in hell. And my husband was so offended. He was like, oh my gosh, how dare you say this to me? And I was like, well, you know, technically my whole family believes this, and sort of explain that to him, that this is basically the foundation of their worldview. And then he got very upset that the rest of my family wasn't telling him the same thing. It's like, well, if you really believe this, why, you know, why aren't you going out and telling everybody all the time that that's their fate? But yeah, I don't know. It's a tricky situation because, yeah, of course you're going to feel judged either way.
And how did your family react to your doubt and confusion? Did you profess this to them, or was it something you kind of kept under your lid?
Yeah, I didn't tell them right away. It was something that came out, well, I guess it was pretty soon after I left Moody that we had a talk about it. And yeah, there were like many fights about it. There was a lot of, we had a lot of difficult conversations. And I mean, I was after that. The years after I left Bible school, I was kind of estranged from them for a while. And then, yeah, I don't know. Eventually, we were able to repair things. And I'm actually very close to my family now. And we've kind of agreed just not to talk about it. Like, it comes up every once in a while. But I think for the most part, we've kind of made peace with it.
Yeah, that's kind of how my family's very Catholic, and I was never into it. And I mean, I don't know. We talk about all sorts of stuff. We talk like my politics and my religion are very different than my parents and my family in general. And with my parents, at least, it's kind of open. I've gotten to the point where we can just banter. I think they finally just like figured out that I'm serious.
Yeah.
You know, it's
so
not...
you left like pretty early, or you felt like you were never really a Catholic, or?
I never connected. I mean, I was like an altar boy for like, you know, 6 months or a year when I was a kid. And I just remember it just made me feel tired and bad. And, you know, yeah. I was just like, it just was not for me. Like, I just don't know how to describe it. But I'm actually, I think the irony is that I'm of the children and, you know, of my parents' kids and of most of my cousins. And, you know, as I look out at my extended family, I don't know the details of everybody's lives, but I would guess that I'm probably among the most intensely interested in spiritual matters. It's not that I'm
really?
Not, yeah, it's not that I'm not interested. It's just that, you know, it's got to make, I'm looking for something that really makes sense to me and has like practical value and doesn't involve the kind of judgment that I maybe felt growing up in Catholicism. And that's not to say that there's not things of value in Catholicism or that it doesn't work for some people. You know, like I don't, that's the whole thing. Like, I don't want to judge, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't, but I also, you know, I want to make sure that like intolerance is rooted out and, you know, religion is often like a bastion of intolerance. So it's confusing. And you said earlier, you referred to it as like your spiritual confusion. And the first thing that came to my mind was that like, what a natural state that should be for human beings. Like, shouldn't we all be confused? If like you're being honest about life and this incarnation that we find ourselves in somehow, and you're not expressing some degree of confusion, like you actually are operating with some kind of certainty, that seems absurd to me.
Yeah. I know. I definitely feel the same way too. But yeah, I think it took me a while to get to that point, you know, because I think when I was first leaving the faith and after I did go through a period of confusion. And then after when I decided I was an atheist, I was like very vehemently an atheist and very much into like rationality. I was like reading like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. And it's funny because I feel like there was a period, particularly like in the early aughts, where that sort of rationalism was very in vogue.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There was like this group called the New Atheists. And it was like this part of this larger cultural trend that, you know, today I feel like a lot of people that are like my age and younger, you know, I think there is much more openness towards spiritual things and toward, like you said, like what you're looking for, like some sort of non-judgmental, more open form of spirituality, whether that's like, you know, sort of New Age traditions or Buddhism or, you know, I don't know, sort of these more mystical forms of faith that allow for doubt.
I feel like because I read a lot of those New Atheists back in the early aughts and, you know, all throughout my 20s and 30s or whatever. And I'm totally with the New Atheists when they are exposing organized religions, you know, for their hypocrisies and their evil deeds and their corruption. Like on all that stuff, I'm like, wow, you know, like, it's pretty hard to argue with Hitchens when he's laying it out like that, you know, and it's pretty hard.
Yeah, he's very convincing.
Yeah, yeah. But where the New Atheists lose me is with their certainty and with the dogmatism around their non-belief, which to me feels very much the other side of the same coin of the certainty of belief. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah,
can't
exactly.
Can't we just have some humility and say we don't know what the fuck is going on here? Like that. That's what
I
want.
Well, I think increasingly people are. I mean, like, the thing is, science is in, like, such flux and uncertainty right now, too. Like, nobody even knows what's going on with, like, physics. You know, I think a lot of that, I don't know if it's because of developments in the past few years, if that's why, you know, it's harder to read those New Atheists. It's harder to read people who have that kind of certainty because it's like, well, you know, a lot of things that we thought were, you know, scientific as though they were like inscribed in the fabric of the universe are seem increasingly fragile and not as sure as they once were.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that we don't know. I think that's really where I've come down on it. Like we are very early in our existence as a species relative to like the long arc of cosmic time. And
yeah,
I just think there's a lot to learn yet. And, you know, I also, like, I don't know, my mind, I seesaw so much because I am, like, persuaded by this argument. Like, have you ever seen, like, a riot of atheists, like a violent uprising of atheists? Like, atheists tend to be pretty peaceful. Like, they're not,
yeah.
There are no, like atheist, quote unquote, holy wars or unholy wars or whatever.
Well,
or is that wrong?
There's, like, well, I mean, you could say, like, sort of these Marxist experiments, like the Soviet Union, like Stalinism. I don't know. I mean, that's the counter argument that's often given is that there are these sort of atrocities that are committed by materialist ideologies. But I don't know. I mean, you can say, I don't know. I don't know where I stand on that, I guess, is my answer to that question.
I probably don't either. Did you by any chance read the Michael Pollan book about psychedelics? Because he's talking a lot about materialist thinking and how, you know, basically over the course of the book, he goes from being very materialist to being much less so after like doing like an ayahuasca circle and taking.
I'm so interested in that. I haven't read his book, but I've listened to like every podcast he's been on.
Okay. Yeah.
And I probably should just read it, but I read the Taolin book Trip too. And he kind of talks about, sort of that experience too. I don't know. I have a lot of fear about psychedelics. But I also like, I don't know. I'm very, I find it, the people's experiences on them very seductive and I have a lot of curiosity about it. And
well, I think that, and it's like it's a very, big fixation of me on this show, but I think it's because it's a bridge between, the physical world and the, you know, what's tangible and knowable and the mystical and the mysterious, you know, and like, there's something very authentic about a psychedelic experience that you can't really explain away, especially if you take the right dose in the right setting. And I think that for me as a kid who had a lot of like confusion and anger and resistance to the tradition in which he was raised and in the culture that he was surrounded by, like I spent the first half of my childhood in Wisconsin, but then in Indiana, I went to junior high and high school, and that's like more of a, there's a more of a religious feel down there, like more of a Southern, mm-hmm. like there's more of a Southern, like social conservative feel to where I was raised, you know? And, I was kind of bristling against that. And, you know, I felt like psychedelic culture when I came to it as like a 17 or 18 year old, and I saw people taking these things mm-hmm. And like got to like, you witness people on this stuff, and then you're in like a, you're at like a dead show, or you're with your friends in the woods, and it's like, well, wow, this is what I wanted at church my whole life. Like, is this is the real shit. Like people are actually like, you know, I don't know, reconfiguring the way they relate to the universe and are making, having big visions or whatever. I don't even know how to language it, but.
No, that sounds very, very appealing to me too. I think I'm just, I know deep in my heart that I'd be the kind of person that has a really like irrevocably bad trip. Just cause I have a lot of, hellfire in my past, and I just feel like all of that stuff would come to the surface, that I've spent a lot of time pushing down.
I worry about it too. But like the Michael Pollan book is, you know, he emphasizes the importance of taking guided trips where you have like a shrink or a shaman or somebody who really knows how to guide people there with you, which is incredibly appealing to me because, you know, I've got a son with health challenges, and I'm like, I know if I take this stuff, I'm just going to go into some spiral, you know, where I'm like fixating on that. And I'm like, I don't know if I can put myself through that, but I guess if I had somebody that I talked to who was like very experienced at taking people down the rabbit hole, that would probably be the thing that would sway me.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I am always going back. I have like all my friends just in the past, I don't know, 5 years or so decided to start doing psychedelics. It's like a very new, I don't know if it's because we're in the Midwest or what, but it's like, I feel like it was a very late thing here. But yeah, I don't know. And then you hear stories about people who like come out on the other side and they're different people. Like they decide they want to give away all their possessions and become a missionary or something. And
go back to Moody Bible College.
Yeah. That's the thing. What if I come out on the other side? This is what I'm saying. I have like all this stuff is still in my subconscious somewhere. Yeah. And so what if that's who I come out on the other side is, you know, going back to Christianity. I don't know. But, yeah, it is. It is. I like the, you know, the sense of getting out of your ego and connecting with the universe. I don't know. I guess I should just try meditation or something. I feel like that's sort of the safer way to go. But
it's slower.
Decades of meditation to get to that point. I mean,
some people have these like, you know, more rapid onset experiences of, you know, what is it called? Kensho or Satori or whatever it is. But most people, it's like a long slog. And, you know, I don't know. It's certainly nothing like, I guess that some people claim that like when you actually do have these flashes of insight or you get into really deep states of meditation, there are some common, you know, commonalities between that and the psychedelic experience. But I don't know. The psychedelic experience feels pretty unique.
Yeah, I know. It's probably not. Yeah. I have doubts about how close it could be.
Well, it's funny too, that you were talking about, like, remember how like you were saying the new atheism was kind of a thing in the early aughts. I feel like psychedelics are definitely having their moment in the late, whatever this is, teens of mm-hmm. the 21st century. It feels like people are, I don't know if it's just the way cultural trends work and things cycle in and cycle out, or if there's something happening in the world of spirituality and faith and economics and politics and, mm-hmm. you know, all these different things sort of converging that are causing people to turn to plant medicines and mm-hmm. maybe to turn to alternate spiritual modalities, because the institutions that are, you know, have been around for a while, or that were in their communities, might not be cutting it for them.
Yeah, it is interesting because, you know, I think around the time that I was writing a lot of these essays, which were, I don't know, sort of the late Obama years, 2014, 2015, whenever I was writing about evangelicalism and trans and evangelicalism, there were all these studies coming out saying that, like, the religious right is dead and all these people are actually leaving Christianity. There's, I don't know, there's like a Pew Forum study, I think, that everybody kept citing, that there were more people than, particularly, I think, more young people than ever before that identified as nuns, N-O-N-E-S, like people who don't identify as religious. And it's interesting that that's, yeah, coinciding with all of these other forms of, or all these other interests in sort of spiritual things, like psychedelics would be one part of it. You know, astrology is really huge right now.
Where do you fall on that? Are you like, do you know everything about your sign? And
no, I know nothing. I mean, I find it, again, like, so appealing if anybody reads a horoscope to me or something. I understand why those things are appealing and why it's compelling to believe in those things, because it's a narrative. It's a way to make sense of your life. And I mean, that's what religion is. It's a narrative about your identity, about history. And, you know, I think it's naive to think like, oh, we can just like get rid of organized religion and people are not going to have that basic craving or impulse, that religious impulse. And so I think, I don't know, it seems like what we're seeing now is people who are, you know, don't feel comfortable in those traditional religions that are sort of looking for a religious experience in a lot of different places, you know, whether it's like even something like CrossFit or like these very intense diet and lifestyle trends. They have kind of like this religious aspect to them where it governs every aspect of your life. You know, it's a way to limit your options the same way that religion sort of limited your options by dictating this very strict set of rules that you followed.
Wow, that's funny that you say that, because I was hiking with my dog, you know, like this week or the week before last, and it was early in the morning, and I'm up in the hills here in LA, and I'm coming down the trail, and there's like a little park area, and I see this group of people, and they're like 20s and 30s or whatever, and it's clearly like an exercise group. But mm-hmm. there's a lot of them. There's probably like 50 of them, 60 of them, and they're in a circle, and they're all like clapping and singing and chanting. And the first thing that popped into my head, I was like, well, here's a cult. Like, immediately, yeah. You know, and I was sort of joking, but then you talk about CrossFit and the way it sort of, you know, it performs a similar function. And I don't think that's inaccurate. And I think that people are starved for community. Like, I guess I don't know. Like, on the one hand, it's like, ooh, creepy, a cult built around like hyper exercise. And then the other part of me is like, wow, it could be worse. You know, like, people just want to be fit and have friends and like take care of themselves.
You know, like, yeah. Yeah. There are, that's true. I mean, they're not, yeah, starting holy wars or whatever, you know, there's not yet. They're, you know, they do hold the CrossFit, the worldwide games here in Madison, Wisconsin. They were, just actually, I think last month here in town. And it's very intense. Like, I didn't go to them myself, but I had a friend who went to report on it. And yeah, I mean, they do see themselves as you know, this institution that, I don't know, they have these large global competitions and who knows where it'll go.
Well, Megan, I think we have a to-do list for you. I think you need to drop acid and start doing CrossFit immediately after this podcast.
Yeah, I think that might be good for my writing, just generally.
That'll be your next collection. And speaking of your writing, congratulations on your book.
Oh, thank you.
It is a collection of essays, and you kind of alluded to it a minute ago, talking about how it all came together sort of in like the late Obama years. But can you talk a bit about, you know, the common thread for listeners who might not be familiar, that kind of runs through the book and the different essays in it? And maybe talk a little bit about why you gravitated to this form.
Yeah, sure. So I guess there's sort of two threads that run throughout the book and intersect at different moments. I write a lot about growing up evangelical and leaving the faith, and then also, you know, how the faith has evolved since I've left. So I wrote an essay for Harper's last spring about Mike Pence, the vice president, and how he helped evangelicals or convinced evangelicals to vote for Trump. I wrote, yeah, so a lot about, you know, and all sort of talking about my own experience and also sort of these larger trends within the church. And then the other thread in the book is about the Midwest, which is also, I mean, to me, it feels like those themes are very interconnected because they're part of my experience. So I write about, you know, living in Madison. My husband and I moved back to Michigan for a year in 2015. And I wrote an essay about that and just how, you know, we moved back to basically the town where I'd grown up and sort of talked about how it had changed over the years. And just sort of what it means to live in the Midwest during a time of political and economic uncertainty. And then as to how I was drawn to the form, I actually started off as a fiction writer and was hoping to just write like short stories and novels, and very unexpectedly sort of gravitated toward nonfiction in my late 20s. I took a nonfiction workshop and just like, I don't know, really fell in love with the form, felt like I was able to say things in a much more direct way than I was trying to say sort of obliquely in fiction. And so I just started writing essays. I think I started writing essays at a time when I was really trying to make sense of my whole experience, both like, what does it mean to be a former Christian? What did that whole experience mean? You know, I think at the time it felt like that experience was very meaningless in a way, or that I felt like I had wasted a lot of time, that I had been duped. And so I think writing about my experience being Christian and then leaving Christianity was a way to help make sense of that and give it sort of a larger meaning.
Have your family members read your book?
They haven't read my book yet. I assume they're going to. They've read some of the individual essays because they're online. Yeah, we had like an interesting debate about particularly. So I wrote an essay about the theology of hell and sort of my struggles with it when I was at Bible college. And that was the one that I know for sure that they read that one because we had a discussion about it. And it was actually a very civil discussion. They like gave me all their counter evidence of things they thought I had gotten wrong. And I sort of just listened because I had already, you know, wrote what I believed in the essay. But yeah, I don't know. They're not incredibly interested in my writing, which is fine with me. I don't really think about them as a readership when I'm writing, because I think it would be kind of paralyzing to do so. So I just kind of just compartmentalize that part. But yeah, I assume, you know, now that it's out, they're gonna get a copy and read it.
Do you have any siblings or other family members who have had similar crises of faith, or are you the one?
So I'm the oldest of five children, and there's one other child, my brother, who ended up leaving Christianity. And everyone else has stayed in the faith. And, you know, they've all sort of like negotiated their own place within it. Like some of them are a little bit more liberal than others and a little more open than, you know, say my parents were when we were growing up. I do have actually my youngest sister is a missionary to Albania. So, you know, she like kind of had the opposite trajectory of me. Like she started off when she was in high school, was not very interested in Christianity and wanted to go to film school. And she actually went to NYU to the Tisch school and wanted to be a filmmaker, and then kind of had this opposite, like a conversion experience basically, where she realized that she wanted to be a missionary, and she dropped out of film school and went to Moody Bible Institute, where I had just left, to study theology there. So that was an interesting experience. And we talked about it a lot at the time. And then that's another thing where it's like, you know, this was all like 10 years ago, and we've kind of just moved on, and we have a close relationship today, but we don't really talk about our respective differences.
Well, you know, ultimately, aren't spiritual undertakings always personal and individual at the end of it? I mean, there's only so much you can do in concert with other people in a way that's authentic. Like, you've got to at some point figure out for yourself what works for you and what you believe.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, right? Like, it's like, I know that there's such a thing as spiritual community, and ideally that happens within a family, but you know, people are going to have different, they're going to be wired differently, or they're going to have different takes on things. That seems like the natural course of it.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I think that's something I had to come to terms with, particularly with my sister, is just being like, you know, she clearly needed this for some reason that I don't understand, the same way I needed to leave it, you know. And it's funny, because I think at the time that I was leaving the faith, I thought I had all these very rational, logical reasons. You know, it was all about these problems with the doctrine. And like, the more I looked back on it, I think it was a lot of emotional issues. It was, you know, a lot of stuff that just didn't resonate with me. Probably a lot to do with the people who were teaching these things that sort of rubbed me the wrong way. You know, I don't think anyone, I mean, we're not like these rational algorithms that respond, you know, to our environment in a very machine-like way. There's also, it's a lot of these sort of, you know, emotional and subliminal things that sway us. Well, to believe one thing or the other.
It's funny, because you're, you know, as the eldest of five, like, you're supposed to be the one who is like the super missionary. Like, you're supposed to be like the kid who like stayed closest to the line or whatever, and you're the one who diverged. So I guess that blows up like the order of birth thing.
Yeah, I don't know how that worked out. Yeah, I'm not only the oldest of five, I'm the oldest of all the grandchildren too in my family, because we're very close with our like cousins too, and they're, you know, we have this very large family, and all of these like 20 cousins are all still Christians too, into their early adulthood now. So I don't know. I don't know why that happened or what was unique about my experience.
Well,
but,
you're obviously super bright and a wonderful writer, and yet you were homeschooled until 10th grade. And I don't mean to presume things about homeschooling, but I've always been in awe of anybody who could possibly take that on and do a good job of it, and also like confused as to whether or not that's even possible. Like, who can actually teach a kid every single subject, and do you know what I'm saying?
Like, oh yeah, well, we weren't taught. Like, we were technically unschooled. We didn't use that term, but that's sort of the tradition we were in, where my mom believed that we would just learn everything we needed to know from experiencing life, basically. So we didn't sit down and have like lessons during the day. She didn't teach us. Like, we had some textbooks that we would get in the mail from some Christian wholesale education company every year, but we rarely read them or did lessons in them. We were really like just left to our own devices for most of the time. So I don't know how we learned anything, really. I mean, I read a lot as a kid because I liked to read, but we didn't do any science, really. You know, like, my mom believed, I mean, we had a textbook that taught creationism, like basically everything you need to know about earth sciences is in the book of Genesis and the creation story. So I didn't experience like a traditional science education until I went to school in 10th grade. And I was like extremely behind, and I don't think I ever caught up. Like, my science knowledge, I mean, I read about a bunch of like popular science books when I dropped out of Moody and tried to catch myself up. But I like definitely didn't have the foundation that I was supposed to have as a child.
Okay, well, that at least makes more sense, because I'm sitting here listening to you going, guys, like, she's, you know, she's clearly got like she's got a handle on it. She's figured it out.
Oh, like, I feel like direly behind in a lot of areas. And I'm just like waiting for people to find out.
But see,
how much basic stuff I don't know.
I think people who have that paranoia sometimes are the ones who are the most well-read. Like, I don't know. Like, when I hear that sort of thing, I'm always like, well, this is the person who's actually like reading popular science books to catch up, which is more than most people who sort of like slept through biology in high school. Do you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I kind of wonder, and maybe this is from my parents brainwashing me about the uselessness of public school, but did you feel like you learned that much, like in the first, I don't know, up until high school? Like, do you learn a lot that really sticks with you?
I peaked in junior high.
Really?
My ninth grade year was the last year of schooling that I really, like of formal schooling that I was really engaged with in a serious way. I was an excellent student in like straight A's across, not even like an A minus, you know, from junior high until 10th grade. And then 10th grade, like, I mean, I was a good student, like in terms of the numbers and the outcome all the way through. But mm-hmm. like my last semester of high school, I failed calculus. I didn't give a shit. I didn't want to go. I was just in like junior year. It was sort of like, you know, it was headed in that direction. So it was kind of like a steady decline yeah. after 10th grade, where part of it, I think, was boredom. Part of it, I think, was just lack of discipline and just being like a adolescent shit. And then I think the other thing is that, you know, there were some traumas that unfolded around me, like not necessarily in my immediate family, but like friends of mine. There was a, like my buddy's brother died of cancer. My neighbor, her mom like dropped dead of a heart attack one day after school.
Oh, wow.
My first best friend lost his, and then like that same week, my first best friend from growing up in Wisconsin lost his brother, and we had to go up for that funeral. His brother was just 9 when he died or something like that. And it was just like this series of like catastrophic, like tragic deaths that I think factored in ways that I didn't even realize now. Like, I guess maybe that's me. Like it might be revisionist history. Like, oh, that's why I was just like, fuck everything.
Well, no, I mean, those things do affect you, especially at that young of an age,
right?
And probably in a way that you're not aware of at the time. So,
well, and especially around like matters of faith and spirituality, like there were a lot of questions and there was a lot of anger, you know. It was like mm-hmm. like I was not finding any kind of answer or solace in the dogma that had been handed to me. And so I think that when, and like I would pose this as a question to you rather than making this like me diving into my adolescent spirituality for like the 74th time on this show. But like, you know, when you start to have this crisis of faith as a young person and you start to have questions that are really legitimate and feel like they have a lot of ground beneath them, like, were you angry in a similar way where you're like, and maybe not in like a textbook angry way, like where you're like angry and shouting and clenching your fists, but maybe like a subtler internal burn mm-hmm. where it's like, you know, the adults in my life, they lied to me or they weren't shooting straight or I didn't get the real answers. Like I've been misled, I guess, or that kind of feeling. Yeah. Was that for
you? Yeah. Yeah. It's complicated because anger was not an emotion that I was allowed to have as a woman in the church. That was just not in my arsenal of emotions, I guess. But I clearly did have a lot of anger, and I think I, you know, for a long time I took it out on myself. I, you know, there was a few years after Bible school where I was drinking very heavily and engaging in a lot of self-harm.
Like, what does that mean? Just like boozing a lot, smoking cigarettes, or like were you like cutting yourself or anything like that, or?
More so just drugs and alcohol. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Me too.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. As sort of a corollary to you leaving, or like sort of not finding the answers you wanted to in Catholicism, or just
partially, but it was also that I had been raised in like a just say no kind of culture, and all of the drugs had been lumped together into one pile and they were all equally bad and terrible and they had no redeeming qualities and they were bad, bad, bad. And then you smoke a joint and you're like, this was fun. Like what the
yeah.
Like I've been sold a bill of goods. And you know, you spoke earlier about, how maybe the crisis of faith that you had or like a factor in it is the fact that you didn't have teachers who necessarily resonated with you. And, mm-hmm. I think that's very true for me too. And I think true for most people you know, had somebody sat me down, I always say this. Now, it's like, you know, hindsight's 20/20, and it's all, I mean, it's sort of speculative, but if somebody had sat me down and like somebody I trusted and been like, okay, pot is this, mushrooms are this, cocaine is this, meth is this, you know, don't do this one. If you want to, if you want to try this one, like, just, you know, don't drive, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, I didn't get any accurate information. And I think had I been given accurate information that would have tested out, I think I would have been less self-destructive, because once I found out that I had been lied to, then it was like, well, I'm going to find everything out for myself. And
you know. Yeah. That's interesting to consider. I don't know. I have considered that. It's like, 'cause I wasn't, you know, like nobody in my immediate or extended family even drank socially when I was growing up. It was a very foreign concept, and, you know, the same thing, whereas all drugs were lumped together and alcohol was lumped in with it. But I guess in my experience, maybe because of, I don't know, I mean, the way that the time of my life when I was sort of starting to indulge in things, there was nothing like joyful or liberating about it. I was like in a very dark place psychologically and like just wanted to disappear. Not in a like let go of your ego sort of connect with the universe way. Like I just wanted to be totally gone. And so I don't know how much of that was due to, you know, whatever genetics, or, you know, just sort of the depression that I was in during that time. But, I don't know. It's interesting to think about that and the role that it played.
Well, yeah, no, it's bringing to mind this, the truth that, you know, it's one thing to be angry because you feel like you didn't get information that could have been helpful to you, or that people lied to you or just misled you, or that you just got bad information or whatever. But there's also something fundamentally sad about breaking from the tradition that you were raised in and feeling disconnected from it.
Yeah, it is. It's like a grieving process. And I think I didn't realize at the time that I was grieving that, and that I had to leave behind, you know, not just for a while my family, but all of my friends in this community that was, you know, part of my whole life. And also this idea of a future, you know, like I think the thing that was hardest for me, more even so than the community or like not believing in God anymore, was this idea that like history was not going anywhere anymore, because that narrative was very strong when I was growing up, was that like everything is leading toward this final point of glorification where Christ is going to return, the earth's going to be restored, like perfection is going to be reinstated on earth. And so to realize that like, well, history is not really going anywhere, we're all just kind of stuck here, life doesn't have any intrinsic meaning. I mean, this is stuff that I feel like Western culture went through like during modernism, basically, like stuff that people realized centuries ago and we sort of dealt with as a culture in mass, you know, in the late 19th, early 20th century. And I was going through that in a way that was very isolated and very alone. And yeah, I did feel like, okay, I've been given the wrong information. Like clearly everybody else has known this all along. And I'm the only one who didn't get the memo. And I do, I mean, like when I hear people like you talking about like, oh, I just like never connected with, you know, religion, or people who ended up leaving, you know, Christianity or whatever when they were like 15 or 17 years old. And it's like very common. Like I think most people who end up leaving a faith tradition or breaking from their parents' faith tradition do so like pretty early in adolescence or early adulthood. And I was doing this in like my mid-20s, and it just felt very late. And I felt like I had like come to this realization very late. And I don't know why that was. I don't know if it was just because we were so sheltered as children and that, you know, I like didn't have access to the information I needed to until pretty late, or it's hard not to feel that I was just like very naive in a way and to like blame myself for it. So I think probably a lot of the anger I was experiencing was, yeah, like directed at myself. Like, why did I believe this? You know, why couldn't I have seen through it?
Yeah, I guess that's a part of it too. See, it's so multifaceted. It's like,
yeah,
it's like anger, it's grief, and then it's also like self-hatred and blaming yourself and feeling, because I have this like the same kind of feelings about myself. Like, why didn't I, like, yeah, so people didn't tell me, like, why didn't I pick up a fucking book and read about it? You know, like, it's not like I didn't have access to the library, you know, like, or
why? Or the internet was a thing when I was in high school. Yeah, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But
you can't be too hard on yourself. I mean, for God's sakes, pun intended, you know, for God's sake, you were raised in a pretty intense culture that it's natural to have had to take some time to sort things out. I mean, you just didn't have access. It's sort of designed to prevent access, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think really the thing that got me out of that feeling sort of sorry for myself and feeling anger is actually writing about those experiences, because I feel like that helped me in a way to gain control over them or give some sort of new meaning to them. And in some cases realize like there were some good things. I think that I am like in a weird way grateful that I grew up in that culture, because I think it is a really unique way to grow up, and that I still see the world in different ways, maybe because of that.
Well, I know, I think it's, you know, we have a lot in common, even though we don't have exactly the same background. But when I was growing up, my dad would always say to me, you know, faith, family, friends. Like, it's like, he's like, my dad is like Ward Cleaver. He's like a great guy, but just like very like, you know, kind of like textbook dad stuff. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that like as an adolescent, you might sort of roll your eyes. But I always go back to that in my head, is that like for whatever differences I may have when it comes down to the details of dogma with my dad, or what tradition you want to follow, or who you want to vote for, whatever, like that's actually really good advice. Like that's in terms of the fundamentals, I don't think you can boil it down much better than that. And it doesn't mean that you have to sign up for some religion or join some cult or something, but it just means that like tending to your spirit, has to be a top priority in your life if you want to have things in order, and that you got to be connected to your family, and you got to take care of your friends. Like that's that, I don't know. That brings me comfort. Like that, I'm a fan of simplicity and things that are practical and useful. And, I've always kind of used that as a way back to my family, and, you know, I don't know, not that I was ever that far, but do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that is something that is people find very comforting and assuring about religion. And I think that is something that, you know, like we were saying before, like people are looking for that in other places now. You know, and I don't know, I think it's still, everything feels very in flux right now. And I think that it'll be interesting to see what the spiritual landscape looks like in America in the next, you know, several decades. I imagine it will change quite a lot.
You would think. And, you know, you talk about like the difficulties of having been raised in a faith and then leaving it, but however far from that faith you wind up landing as an adult, the fact that you were raised in it, it does offer you a set of experiences and tools and like a level of engagement with big questions. Like even if like your, you know, your ability to question things is really like heavily circumscribed or whatever, like, I don't know, like it does prepare you in a way to set out on your own. Like, and it does predispose you to want to entertain these things if you're a person who is like readerly and curious and like open.
Yeah. I do think there is, for one, like the concern with big questions and like, what does this ultimately mean? You know, that was something we were constantly asking ourselves as Christians. I think that still informs my view on a lot of things. And then also it seems very counterintuitive, but you know, because of stereotypes about Christians, but I really feel like I was taught a lot of critical thinking skills as a Christian, just because we were constantly critiquing the culture and talking about how it was false. You know, pastors and my parents used to refer to the world, and this was basically anything that was like the secular world, like anything that wasn't Christianity. And we were always talking about these different messages that the world was trying to give us, you know, and it was in everything. It was in advertising, television, popular culture. You know, we were constantly kind of doing this type of deconstruction. You know, and then in Bible school too, I mean, we had like very, we were taught like a very intense form of hermeneutics, very close reading, basically. You know, we read the Bible in a way that was a lot more intense than like your average lay person, and a lot more rigorous. And so I just
listened to the audiobook, but.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, I'm sure you get something out of it that way too. But, yeah, I think just like having those skills, have carried over to a lot of the work I do now as a reader and a writer. I didn't, you know, it took me a long time to realize that maybe that's where I got some of those, at least those inclinations to, you know, look at things with that sort of scrutiny and intensity.
So what did your parents do growing up? Like, did they work in like the church, or were they?
Yeah, my mom, my mom was always a stay-at-home mom. She was trained as a nurse, and then she never practiced. She kind of stayed home and homeschooled us, quote unquote. But yeah, when I refer to my parents, I'm actually referring to my mom and my stepfather. So my biological dad actually left our family when I was, 11 years old. And, I actually don't have a relationship with him today, but my mom remarried and is still remarried to my stepfather. And he was in industrial sales for many years. He sold lubrication systems to big factories like Caterpillar and places like that. So he traveled. That was one of the reasons why we moved so much growing up, is he kept getting transferred to different places around the Midwest. And he was like the sales rep for that state, basically. And then around the time I went to college, they both became small business owners. They own a gas station in Michigan right now. So that's what they do for their business.
It's a good, I mean, people need gas, right?
Yeah, they still do. I mean, yeah, nothing is, I don't know if electric cars are ever going to come back, but yeah, for now people need gas. But it's weird. It's like they, so they have a gas station and a car wash, and, the car wash is like very dependent on the weather. So, you know, we've had like, if they don't get a lot of snow in a particular winter, not as many people wash their car, or if it's not the right amount of like snow and sunny days, they talk about their livelihood like the way that farmers do. They're very much like dependent on these natural forces that are totally out of their control.
So like your stepdad is in the same faith tradition as your mom, like that was in place. And then is your mm-hmm. biological dad also part of that faith tradition?
He was kind of like, okay, so my mom and my biological dad met at Wheaton College. So they were both Christians. But he was always a little bit more, I think, on the fence about it. And he actually had a lot of mental health issues, which is part of the reason why they divorced. And so I don't know, it's kind of hard to know where he was, but and a lot of it, you know, when I was a child, I didn't really understand exactly like the differences between their beliefs, because they raised us, you know, we went to church every Sunday. We were like very much a Christian home, even when he was married to my mom. And then over the years, you know, kind of like hearing more of the story from other family members, it turns out I think he was maybe not quite on board with it as much as she was.
Hmm. And you say you're not in touch with him at all, like, so you wouldn't be able to like find that out.
No, it's funny. I sort of got in touch with some of his family members. Like, his sister reached out to me through like my writing, because I had that article I think I mentioned I wrote about Mike Pence for Harper's Magazine last spring, and like heard from all these people who I had not heard from since like childhood, who were like, hey, I saw you had this piece in Harper's. And yeah, so one of the people who reached out was my dad's sister, who I hadn't seen since I was a child either. And so she has kind of caught me up a little bit on what's going on with that side of the family. But they all live on the West Coast in Oregon. So yeah, I haven't seen any of them since I was very young.
Wow. Well, how do you identify today? Like, in terms of your spirituality and religious affiliation or lack thereof. You kind of talked about being an atheist in the aftermath of your initial crisis of faith, but I imagine you probably don't identify as an atheist, or is that wrong?
I would say I'm more agnostic today. So, yeah, I mean, like we were talking about uncertainty, I just feel like it's really like pompous to say that, you know, you know for sure. The same way it's like really problematic to say you know for sure that there is a God. It's like if you can't answer the question in the affirmative, you can't answer it in the negative, you know. So I don't know. I guess agnosticism makes more sense to me today. I've tried different ways of cultivating a spiritual life. I have done meditation, and it is something I'm more open to today in general, but I don't have like a faith practice or a discipline that I do necessarily. But it is, I guess it's something I'm just generally more interested in and curious about, as opposed to how I was, you know, maybe 10 years ago.
And what about your reading life? You know, do you read about this stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I do a lot of, most of what I have been reading lately is for like research, like nonfiction stuff for various essays I was writing. But then for my own pleasure, I've mostly just been reading fiction lately. It's funny because when I was writing fiction, I kind of reached this terminus with fiction where I was like, oh, I just like can't read fiction anymore because I'm writing it. I'm totally immersed in it. After I'd been writing essays for many years, I had the opposite experience where now all I want to read is fiction, particularly like novels that are written by women in their 50s. Like that's pretty much all I want to read lately. And I don't know why that is, but like, yeah, I love the Rachel Cusk trilogy.
Uh-huh.
And I read, that Magda Sasbo, I can't remember how to pronounce her name, wrote this novel called The Door that was translated several years ago, and I never got around to reading it. I just read that over the summer. I just want to hear like women with wisdom talking about their lives in a way that feels kind of essayistic, but as classist fiction. I don't know. I have a very narrow class of fiction that I enjoy reading right now, but I really, really enjoy it.
But it's bad. Like, that's the thing. Like, I'm always mystified by people who like are like way wide open in terms of their reading tastes and just love to just read things and try things out. I'm like, I feel very specific about it. I feel like I feel like I have to read books that I really need in my life, like for instruction or something, you know?
Yeah. I think that's a natural thing to happen once you've been reading for a while too. I mean, I think when you first start, everything is new and you want to read a variety of things, but it's like after, you know, you get to a certain age, you're like, you know what you like. I don't want to waste time on books that I don't enjoy.
But you also know what you need. Like you also have probably less free time. So you're like, okay, I got like 20 minutes with this thing before I like pass out. Most likely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it too. I know. I feel like I have way less time for like leisure reading, and I really do need it. Like even though I'm not writing fiction, even though I'm writing nonfiction, I do feel like it's really necessary to read, fiction and just to keep up a reading life. I think it does affect, just like my sanity as a person and my ability to write and think on the page.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And, you said you're working on nonfiction right now. So are you working on more essays or are you working on something different?
I'm supposed to be writing a book. When I signed the deal for the essays, it was technically a 2-book deal. So I've been doing a lot of research for this second project, which has been difficult and kind of evolving.
You know what it should be called?
What?
I'm supposed to be writing a book.
That is definitely the working title. It's tricky. It's hard because I've been an essay. I've never tried to write a book-length project, obviously. My form has been the essay, and I feel like I'm so like ingrained in that form. It's so intuitive to me. It's really hard to try to write something longer. Like everything feels just very baggy and unnecessary, which I guess that's how it feels, but I don't know. Then I've, you know, of course, procrastinate and take on other essay projects. So I actually wrote a piece about homeschooling over the summer for M+1, which is, I think, going to be in their winter issue, maybe. So, yeah, I spent a lot of time, like, researching the history of homeschooling in preparation for that essay, and then started reading, like, Rousseau and stuff, too, because it seemed relevant. So, yeah, I don't know. I've been working on a little bit of everything.
And what about, like, I can't let you go without asking you about this Pence essay that you wrote, and Trump and Pence and the evangelical wing of the Republican Party, which is, like, pretty much the most enthusiastic and reliable voting bloc for Trump, right? I mean, and how that happened. And
more evangelicals voted for Trump than voted for George W. Bush, which is remarkable to me.
Why?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of different theories about it. My piece about Pence was actually very, very narrow, because I was writing about him at a time when people had already written a lot about him. There was that big Jane Mayer piece in The New Yorker, and people had already sort of gone over, you know, his biography, his, you know, ties to big business, all of these sort of narratives about him. So I wrote about, so this is kind of difficult to explain in a nutshell, but I'll try to. I was trying to write about the narratives about him within evangelicalism, and it seemed like the common narrative from what I was reading was that he was going to be this mediator figure or an intercessor, where he was going to sort of attenuate Trump's moral excesses and help sort of bring him back to this path where he was going to help Christians. And so as Christians are talking about this, they keep referring back to these Old Testament narratives where there were, in periods in which the Jews were in exile, say in Babylon, they were under this oppressive pagan power, under these sort of authoritarian rulers like Nebuchadnezzar. And then there was, you know, there would be this figure like Daniel, say, who was like a Jewish man who was, you know, from the Hebrew elite, who would go serve in this pagan court, and he would sort of help Nebuchadnezzar do good things for the Jews. And so what was happening in Christian discourse around the time of the 2016 election was that people were saying, like, oh, Pence is going to be our Daniel. Like, you know, Trump is this ugly sort of Nebuchadnezzar, this like pagan ruler who doesn't believe in our God. But there's this tradition, you know, there's this history of God protecting his people by sending these intercessor figures, and who rise up to be like number two in the pagan court of their era. So that's what my essay was about. And it was like very difficult to write because I had to explain this whole history of like Jewish exile narratives and then talk about how Christians were using them. Because like evangelicals today, even though they are ostensibly in power now, they believe that they're in exile within American culture. They believe that America is a post-Christian nation and that they're in this very like tenuous position within the culture. And so, you know, obviously there's a lot of factors that convince them to vote for Trump. But part of that narrative was that like, okay, we've got one of our people on the inside and he's going to help, you know, do things like get the Supreme Court nominee that we want and, you know, protect religious liberties and things like that.
And Pence is like really like all in on that. Like, it's not just like convenient for him because he knows.
Yeah. No, that's the thing is that, you know, I went into this thinking like, oh, these, I'm just writing about sort of these narratives surrounding him. But like, I started listening to his speeches and he like very deliberately evokes these passages from the Old Testament in his speeches as this sort of like dog whistle, you know, rhetoric for evangelicals, like people who know what these passages are about. They're sort of connecting the dots and like, oh, he's talking about, you know, exile, or he's talking about, you know, sort of aligning himself with these Old Testament figures. And so, yeah, I do think that he's aware of it on some level. I don't know. I mean, I don't think that he like created the story by any means, but I think that my sense is that he is aware of it and sort of plays into it.
But I mean, like, is it politically expedient for him? Do you think that like deep down he's like, eh, it's bullshit, but these people...
No, like, I don't think he'd, I mean, that was another thing. I went into it thinking that, you know, this with this very cynical idea that he was just using religious narratives to exploit people and he was just obsessed with power and everything. And, you know, the more I read about him and, you know, I went to his church, his home church in Indianapolis and talked to his pastor for like 2 hours. And I think he's legit. Like, he is a true believer. Which is like kind of more frightening,
right?
I know. Yeah, that he's not just using this as this like opiate of the masses or whatever. Like, he really believes in these, you know, Old Testament stories and this idea that America is like continuing on carrying on these legacies of, you know. Yeah, I don't know. It was very interesting to. I think I didn't realize how deep it was until I started researching it, and then I got very into it. And I haven't really revisited any of that since I published the piece, and haven't really kept up with what he's doing or what his role is in the White House. It seems unclear. But
yeah, it's all like I'm very. You know, there are days when I'm like, he's obviously implicated in all this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was handpicked by Paul Manafort and, you know, there's no way that he's scot-free.
Yeah, no, I don't think his hands are clean at all. No.
But then I'll sometimes read something and it's like, well, maybe he is actually shrewd and has kept quiet and found ways to, like, take himself off of email chains to not that he's like innocent, but that he's like going to be hard to pin down. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so that if Trump does go down, he is going to be prime to step in. And what scares me about the like an evangelical president of his degree of intensity is this notion that, like, you know, they're happy for the second coming and, you know, like this world is just like a stopover onto the way to the promised land. And like,
yeah,
you know, like they're not as afraid of Armageddon as they should be, you know.
Right. Yeah. Why? I mean, especially on things like climate change, it's like, of course, that's why they're not interested in saving this earth, because they know it's going to go up in flames in the end anyway. You know, I mean, like, no, I don't think any evangelical will say that outright, but that is why they're not interested, you know, in sort of those, you know, preservation and conservation efforts.
Well, I will leave you with this thought. I think I might keep talking to you if you say something interesting. So just be warned.
Okay.
But you know, I'm a fan of, I like reading the Christian left. You know, there are certain writers in that tradition that inspire me and that get me excited, about the possibility that there could be like a more open and tolerant and interesting and practical application of Christian dogma. And like, it just, mm-hmm. I don't know, it just feels like sometimes it's a failure of the teacher and not the teaching, sort of like what we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, sometimes I'm like, you know, a person like Megan O'Giblin, you know, who has all this experience in the church and went to Moody Bible College, like, maybe the answer is to, like, to re-engage as opposed to distance. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Because if you
change
just
it from the inside.
Yeah. Or just like, we need people who can, or at least present a different understanding of these teachings that, mm-hmm. like, reflects your values as they exist right now. You wouldn't have to like reconstitute yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But if people like me and you and whoever else has gone through something like this simply turn our back on it, well, then that's kind of like ceding the field to the people that we felt might have misled us or gotten it wrong or had like corrupt intent, you know?
Yeah. Well, there is kind of a large debate about that among younger evangelicals now, many of whom are not calling themselves evangelicals anymore because they've become really disillusioned with that kind of perversion of the faith, particularly the degree to which Christianity has been bound up with right-wing politics and, you know, has...
like the prosperity gospel or whatever. And
yeah, prosperity gospel. And also just the fact that for a lot of, you know, when I was growing up, it was like evangelicalism was synonymous with the Republican Party. And, you know, there are a lot of younger evangelicals who are concerned with social justice, who are, you know, want to include LGBT communities in the church and don't want to, you know, talk about like, oh, God's going to send you to hell, you know, and I think that there's a lot of discussion about whether, yeah, they can still call themselves evangelicals or not. So there's a lot of young people that are now identifying as ex-evangelical, as sort of like people who grew up in that culture and have since become more liberal. And some of them have sort of gravitated toward more mainline congregations like, you know, Lutheranism or Episcopal churches or things like that. And some of them have actually like don't go to church anymore, but still identify as vaguely Christian and maybe are a little bit more mystical.
See, that's I want to join like the vaguely Christian. That's what I want. That's the movement.
Oh, there's lots of them right now. Yeah. This is a perfect time to do that if that's what you want to do.
Well, I want it to be called vaguely Christian.
Vaguely Christian. Yeah. You could be the, yeah, they definitely need some branding help right now because nobody's come up with a better word, than evangelical. There's like, yeah, that term, particularly after the 2016 election, has become really contentious because it does have political connotations and there's a lot of anti-Trump evangelicals who don't want to be grouped under that umbrella anymore.
Good.
Yeah. I know. So I think, yeah, it is. I mean, I think things are going to change within the church. And I have thought, I don't know, I've thought about, you know, what if it did change to a degree? Would I be okay going back? I went to a Unitarian church a couple years ago just to like check it out. But I just felt like it was so like foofy. I don't know, like people were coming up to give prayers for their cat and stuff. And I was just like, what is the point? You know, it's like there's a point at which it becomes so open that it's about nothing.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just like the latent fundamentalist in me that, you know, I just like part of me maybe really wants some sort of like a hardline doctrine or something. But I don't know. You have to have some sort of meaning. You have to be offering people something beyond just, you know, feeling good about themselves. I don't know.
Yeah. I agree with you. Like I gravitate to Buddhism and, there's like something called the five precepts mm-hmm. or I think there's also like there's a list of 14 too, but they boil it down to five and I don't read them every day, but I try to read them regularly and, or like the Noble Eightfold Path or, you know, mm-hmm. they're like, that's not nothing, you know, that's not like wide open, do whatever you want. It's actually pretty hard to live by that stuff. And nobody does it perfectly is kind of the emphasis, when it's taught, but it's like the stars you steer by. And, it's hard to lead a good, solid life. You know, it's hard to do this, like to lead a spiritual life of real substance, and rigor, you know, it takes work.
Yeah, it does. I know. I think I have a lot more respect for Buddhism than I do these sort of like maybe marginal kind of new agey forms of Christianity. Just because what you're saying, you know, I think it does require a lot of discipline and a lot of work. And I think that's part of what's appealing to people too, is this idea that you can, you know, if you follow this path, and it is maybe the challenge is part of the appeal too, but if you follow it, then you're going to have this transformation. You're going to become another person. You know, I think that idea of transformation is really appealing to people. It's very appealing to me too.
Well, it's just for me, it's like, transformation would be awesome. Like, don't get me wrong. And like, maybe I'll be one of these people who has the flash, but like for me, just like basic sanity, like a little peace. Like I don't have high hope. Like my aspirations are pretty small. Like I just want to catch myself in anger before I speak or act. I want to take care of like depression and, you know, like crazy self-doubt and all the things that sort of mm-hmm. plague us, you know, in a way that's like healthier and authentic and causes me to lean into those things rather than to sort of like try to repress them or, you know, mm-hmm. or castigate myself for experiencing them, you know, which isn't the answer either. So just kind of like, it's like trying to create a healthy psychological system for myself. That's really what it's about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like probably psychoanalysis played that role for people for a lot of the last several decades. And, you know, I don't know. I think people probably go to therapy for a lot of the same reasons now, but I don't know if it's as a robust solution as it once was. You know, it does feel like more people are looking toward things like meditation and these other sort of spiritual practices.
I think it feels to me like therapy is like kind of a guided meditation in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're verbal, like if you're sitting there meditating and you're thinking to yourself like, oh God, I suck. I want to die. I hate life. I'm mad at myself. I'm sad about my cat, you know, whatever it is. Like,
yeah.
You know, you're having all these thoughts. Like in therapy, you're talking them out, you know, and if you're in an honest, open, like trusting environment and you're willing to go there with your therapist, then that person can theoretically help guide you through them, and maybe that expedites the process of like healing and transcendence or whatever. So
yeah,
I don't know, but it's like, where do you find that therapist?
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't think I've ever found that therapist. Yeah. I mean, I was going to therapy during that sort of awful time I was talking about earlier, and maybe wasn't like, I don't know, in a place to benefit from it exactly. So I kind of have like, I don't know, I get down about therapy, and I didn't find it useful personally. I know people who find it enormously useful, and I know there's all types of different methods, but yeah, I think ideally it would be sort of a guided meditation or a way to, you know, the same thing like what psychedelics do, like just getting your brain out of those rigid patterns and helping you see things in a new way.
Yeah. Well, they say like, you know, you take psychedelics, it's like, you know how you defrag your hard drive or whatever?
Yeah.
It's like, I think there's some science coming back that's kind of what happens.
Yeah.
So
I would love for that, but without the Christian stuff coming
right.
out. Yeah. If I could just get that drug, like maybe I'll just wait until they have some special boutique drug for former evangelicals.
Do you think that you have a kind of PSD or PTSD?
I don't know. I've never used that term, but yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's funny because I often find myself like defending evangelicalism because I live in a community now where most of my friends are not Christians or have no connection with that world at all. And, you know, I get into a place when I'm here where I'm very like healthy and happy and sort of like, hey, it's not all bad, you know. And then when I go back to visit my family in Michigan, like I was back there for... I actually went back for 2 weeks this summer, which was too long. And I went to church with my family, and I was like very immersed in their world for a long time. And I kind of, yeah, I reverted to my angry post-Christian self. And maybe that was PTSD. I don't know. I got very agitated at one point.
I believe the term is triggering, right? You were triggered.
Yeah, sure. Triggered. Yeah. Yeah. Why not? Yeah.
But, you know, if it's any consolation, I think everybody in some form, when they go back to visit their family, especially for 2 weeks and when they're, you know, you're in your 30s. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I would guess that like a solid 90% of people wind up triggered and angry at some point.
That's true. Yeah, it's hard to know how much of that is like the Christian stuff or how much is just family. But yeah, I definitely get, I think I gotta be more deliberate about limiting visits in the future.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's been such a pleasure talking with you, and I'm so glad that we got to spotlight your collection in the book club this month. And I just thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me so openly about all this stuff. And I thank you for writing this book and kind of sharing your thoughts and your stories on this subject matter, because I feel like voices like yours who dive deep and are really thoughtful about this stuff, like you've got to have readers out there who are from a similar tradition, who have a similar kind of confusion, but might not be able to articulate it. Or language it for themselves. And that's just one subset of readers. I mean, there are many different kinds of people who will enjoy your book, but I think of those people in particular and how important a book like this is for somebody who might be like, I don't know, 17 and like, what the fuck, you know? And like,
yeah, and that would be my ideal reader if I could reach somebody like that for sure.
I'm sure you will. And I'm sure if you haven't heard from that kid, it's going to happen sooner or later.
Yeah. I have heard from some people. I think probably I get emails occasionally from readers, but the people I've heard from the most are definitely people who've grown up in that culture themselves or have left it. Because, it is a very isolating experience. So hopefully I can connect. Hopefully that my experience resonates in some way with other people.
Well, if you ever find yourself really, feeling lost, you can always come out to Los Angeles and join Scientology.
Yeah. We'll see. I would love to come to Los Angeles sometime, though. I dream about L.A. I've never been there, but it just seems like a wonderful place.
Well, get out here. When the Madison winter is like sort of crushing you. That's the best time to be in L.A. anyways, because the desert in the winter is when it's at its best. So,
okay.
If you get out this way, look me up.
Okay.
Well, I definitely am. Megan, it's great talking to you. And
thanks so much for having me.
Congratulations again on your book.
All right, thank you.
All right, that's Megan O'Giblin. Her essay collection is called Interior States. It is the official October pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. It is available now from Anchor Books. Megan O'Giblin, and the essay collection is Interior States. Go get it. You can find her online at meganogiblin.com. She's on Twitter. Her handle there is @MegOGiblin. Thanks to Kill Rockstars and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music, as always. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. If you want to support the show, patreon.com/otherpplpod. So I got some more questions. I forgot to answer the question, what's a question you regret not asking? I always feel like I leave jokes on the table, or it's different for different people. I try to ask everything that comes to mind, but sometimes I miss things, I usually regret missing jokes, like opportunities to have said something. Or ask something. So many regrets. Twiggy is learning to heal off leash. I just want to give you an update on my dog. She's really coming along. Very proud of her. What's your favorite type of pasta? Joe Grantham asks. Joe Grantham Sr. Angel hair. My mom,